Ash, who paged me? He said into the phone when Edgar picked up. After Edgar put the phone down, he said, I'll hold a few minutes, but tell him I'm in the middle of an interview. What's so important? With his back still to the couch and Ben still talking, Bosch turned slightly to the right and cocked his head as if he were holding the phone to his left ear, where Ben could not see it. Bosch brought the handset down to stomach level, used the knife to pop off the earpiece cover, clearing his throat as he did this, and then pulled out the audio receiver. With one hand, he connected the bug to its battery. He had practiced doing it earlier while waiting for the new car in the fleet yard at Wilcox. Then he used his fingers to shove the bug and battery into the barrel of the handset. He put the receiver back in and snapped on the cover, coughing loudly to camouflage any sound. Okay, Bosch said into the phone. Well, tell him I'll call back when I'm through here. Thanks, man. He put the phone back on the desk while returning the knife to his pocket. He went back to the couch where Eleanor was writing in a notebook. When she was finished, she looked at Bosch, and Bosch knew without any sign that now the interview would shift into a new direction.
Mr. Ben, she said, are you sure that is all you had in the box?
Yes, sure. Why do you ask me so much?
Mr. Ben, we know who you are and the circumstances of your coming to this country. We know you were a police officer.
Yes, so what I mean?
We also know other things.
We know, Bosch cut in. You were very highly paid as a police officer in Saigon, Mr. Ben. We know that for some of your work you were paid in diamonds. What did he mean, what he say?
Ben said, looking at Eleanor and gesturing with his hand to Bosch. He was lapsing into the defense of language barrier. He seemed to know less English as the interview went on.
It means what he says, she answered. We know about the diamonds you brought here from Vietnam, Captain Ben. We know you kept them in the safe deposit box. We believe the diamonds were the motivation for the vault break-in.
The news didn't shake him. He may have already considered as much. He did not move. He said,
It not true.
Mr. Ben, we've got your package, Bosch said. We know all about you. We know what you were in Saigon, what you did. We know what you took with you when you came here. I don't know what you are into now. It all looks legit, but we don't really care. What we do care about is who ripped off that bank. And they ripped it off because of you. They took the collateral for all this and everything else you've got. Now, I don't think we are telling you something that you probably haven't figured out or thought about on your own. In fact, you might have even thought your old partner, Nguyen Tran, was behind it because he knew what you had and maybe where it was. Not a bad guess, but we don't think so. In fact, we think he is next on the list. Not a crack formed on the stone that was Bin's face. Mr. Ben, we want to talk to Tran, Bosch said. Where is he? Ben looked down through the coffee table in front of him to the three-headed dragon on the rug beneath it. He put his hands together on his lap, shook his head, and said,
Where did Tran?
Eleanor glared at Bosch and tried to salvage what rapport she had had with the man before he butted in.
Captain Ben, we're not interested in taking any action against you. We simply want to stop another vault break-in before it happens. Can you help us, please?
Ben didn't answer. He looked down at his hands. Look, Ben, I don't know what you've got going on this, Bosch said. You might have people out there trying to find the same people we are, I don't know. But I'm telling you right now, you are out of it. So tell us where Tran is.
I don't know it, man.
We are your only hope. We have to get to Tran. The people that ripped you off, they're in the tunnels again, right now. If we don't get to Tran this weekend, there won't be anything left for you or him.
Bin remained a stone, as Bosch expected.
Eleanor stood up.
Think about it, Mr. Bin, she said.
We're running out of time, and so is your old partner, Bosch said, as they headed for the door. After walking through the showroom door, Bosch looked both ways for traffic and ran across Vermont to the car. Eleanor walked it, anger making her strides stiff and jerky. Bosch got in and reached to the floor behind the front seat for the Nagra. He turned it on and set the recording speed at its fastest level. He didn't think the wait would be long. He hoped all the electronic equipment in the store would not skew the reception. Eleanor got in the passenger side and started to complain.
That was magnificent, she said. We'll never get anything out of that guy now. He's just going to call up Tron and... What the hell is that?
Something I picked up from the shoe flies. They dropped a bug in my phone. Oldest trick in the IAD book.
And you just put it in...
She pointed across the street, and Bosch nodded.
Bosch, do you realize what could happen to us? What this means? I'm going back in there and getting...
She opened the car door, but he reached across and pulled it closed. You don't want to do that. This is our only way to get to Tron. Bin wasn't going to tell us no matter how we handle the interview, and deep down behind those angry eyes, you know it. So it's this or nothing. Bin warns Tron, and we never know where he is, or we use this to maybe find him. Maybe. We'll probably know soon enough. Eleanor looked straight forward and shook her head.
Bosch, this could mean our jobs. How could you do this without consulting me?
For that reason, it could mean my job. You didn't know.
I'd never prove it. The whole thing looks like a setup. I keep him occupied while you do your little charade on the phone.
It was a setup, only you didn't know. Besides, Bin and Tron are not the targets of our investigation. We are not gathering evidence against them, just from them. This will never go in a report. And if he finds the bug, he can't prove I put it there. There was no register number. I looked. The suits weren't stupid enough to make it traceable. We're clear. You're clear. Don't worry.
Harry, that is hardly reassuring.
The red light on the Nagra flicked on. Someone was using Bin's phone. Bosch checked to make sure the tape was rolling. Eleanor, you make the call, Bosch said, holding the recorder up on the palm of his hand. Turn it off if you want. Your choice. She turned and looked at the recorder, then at Bosch. Just then the dialing stopped, and it was silent in the car. A phone began to ring at the other end of Bin's call. She turned away. Someone answered the phone. A few words were exchanged in Vietnamese, and then more silence. Then a new voice was on the line, and a conversation began, also in Vietnamese. Bosch could tell one of the voices belonged to Bin. The other sounded like a man about Bin's age. It was Bin and Tron together again. Eleanor shook her head and forced a short laugh.
Brilliant, Harry. Now, who do we get to translate? We aren't letting anyone else know about this. We can't risk it.
I don't want to translate it. He turned the receiver off and rewound the tape. Get out your little pad and pen.
Bosch adjusted the recorder to its slowest speed and hit the play button. When the dialing started, it was slow enough that Bosch could count the clicks. Bosch called the numbers out to Eleanor, who wrote them down. They had the number Bin had dialed. The phone number was a 714 area code, Orange County. Bosch switched the receiver on. The telephone conversation between Bin and the unknown man was continuing. He turned it off and picked up the radio microphone. He gave a dispatcher the phone number and asked for the name and address that went with it. It would take a few minutes while someone looked it up in a reverse directory. Meantime, Bosch started the car and headed south toward Interstate 10. He had already connected with the 5 and was heading into Orange County when the dispatcher got back to him. The phone number belonged to a business called the Tan Phu Pagoda in Westminster. Bosch looked over at Eleanor, who looked away. Little Saigon, he said. Bosch and Wish got to the Tan Phu Pagoda from Bin's business in an hour. The pagoda was a shopping plaza on Bolsa Avenue where no sign was printed in English. The building was off-white stucco with glass fronts on the half-dozen shops that lined the parking lot. Each was a small establishment that sold mostly unneeded junk like electronic equipment or T-shirts. There were competing Vietnamese restaurants on either end. Next to one of the restaurants was a glass door that led to an office or business without a front display window. Though neither Bosch nor Wish could decipher the words on the door, they immediately figured it was the entrance to the shopping center office.
We need to get in there and confirm that's Tron's place, see if he's there and if there are other exits, Bosch said.
We don't even know what he looks like,
Wish reminded him. He thought a moment. If Tron wasn't using his real name, it would tip him off to go in asking for him.
I've got an idea, Wish said. Find a payphone, then I'll go in the office. You dial the number you got off the tape, and when I'm in there, I'll see if it rings. If I hear a phone, we have the right place. I'll also try to scope out Tron and the exits.
Phones might be ringing in there every 10 seconds, Bosch said. It might be a boiler room or a sweatshop. How will you know it's me?
She was silent a moment.
Chances are they don't speak English, or at least not well, she said. So you ask whoever answers to speak English or get someone who can. When you get someone who understands, say something that will get a reaction I'll be able to see.
You mean if the phone rings in a place where you will see? She shrugged, her eyes showing him she was tired of his shooting down every suggestion she made.
Look, it's the only thing we can do. Come on, there's a phone. We don't have a lot of time.
He drove out of the parking lot and a quarter block down to a payphone out front of a liquor store. Wish walked back to the Tanfu Pagoda, and Bosch watched until she reached the door of the office. He dropped a quarter in the phone and dialed the number he had written on his pad in front of Bin's. The line was busy. He looked back at the office door. Wish was gone from view. He dropped the quarter and dialed again. Busy. He did it in quick succession two more times before he got a ring. He was thinking that he had probably dialed the wrong number when the call was answered.
Tan Fu,
a male voice said. Young, Asian, probably early 20s, Bosch thought. Not Tran.
Tan Fu? Bosch asked.
Yes, please.
Bosch could not think of what to do. He whistled into the phone. The comeback was a staccato verbal attack of which Bosch could not understand a single word or sound. Then the phone at the other end was slammed down. Bosch walked back to the car and drove back toward the shopping plaza and into the narrow parking lot. He was cruising through it slowly when Wish appeared at the glass door with a man, an Asian. Like Bin, he had gray hair and had the aura, unspoken power, unflexed muscle. He held the door open for Eleanor and nodded to her as she said thanks. He watched her walk off and then disappeared inside again.
Harry, she said as she got in the car, what did you say to the guy on the phone?
Not a word. So it was that office?
Yeah, I think that was our Mr. Tran who held the door for me. Nice guy.
So what did you do to become such great pals?
I told him I was a real estate lady. When I went in, I asked to see the boss. Then Mr. Grayhair came out of a back office. He said his name was Jimmy Buck. I said I represented Japanese investors and asked if he was interested in taking an offer on the shopping center. He said no. He said, in very fine English, I buy, I don't sell. Then he escorted me out. But I think that was Tran, something about him.
Yeah, I saw it, Bosch said. Then he picked up the radio and asked dispatch to run the name Jimmy Buck on the NCIC and DMV computers. Eleanor described the inside of the office, a central reception area, a hallway running behind it with four doors, including one at the rear that looked like an exit, judging by the double lock. No women. At least four men other than Buck. Two of them looked like hired muscle. They stood up from the reception room couch when Buck walked out of the middle door in the hallway. Bosch drove out of the lot and around the block. He cut up the alley that ran behind the shopping plaza. He stopped when he had driven far enough to see a gold stretch Mercedes parked next to a rear door to the complex. There was a double lock on the door.
That's got to be his wheels, Wish said.
They decided they would watch the car. Bosch drove on by it to the end of the alley and parked behind a dumpster. Then he realized it was full of garbage from the restaurant. He backed out and drove out of the alley completely. He parked on the side street so that by looking out the passenger side of the car, they both could see the rear end of the Mercedes. Bosch could also look at Eleanor at the same time.
So, I guess we wait, she said.
I guess so. No way of telling whether he'll do anything after Bin's warning. Maybe he did something after Bin got ripped off last year and we're just spinning our wheels.
Bosch got a radio call back from the dispatcher. Jimmy Buck had a clean driving record. He lived in Beverly Hills and he had no criminal record. Nothing else.
I'm going back to the phone, Eleanor announced.
Bosch looked at her.
I have to check in. I'll tell Rourke we're set up on this guy and see if he can't shake someone loose to maybe call some banks and run his name, to see if he's a customer. I'd also like to run him on the property computer. He said, I buy, I don't sell. I'd like to know what he buys.
Fire a shot if you need me, Bosch said, and she smiled as she opened the door.
You want something to eat?
She asked. I'm thinking about getting takeout for lunch from one of those restaurants up front.
Just coffee, he said. He hadn't eaten Vietnamese food in 20 years. He watched her walk around to the front of the center. About 10 minutes after she was gone, as Bosch watched the Mercedes, he saw a car pass by the other end of the alley. He immediately made it as a police sedan. A white Ford LTD without wheel covers, just the cheap hubcaps that revealed the matching white wheels. It had been too far away for him to see who was in it. He alternately looked at the Mercedes and then at the rearview mirror to see if the LTD was coming around the block. But in 5 minutes, he never saw it. Wish was back 10 minutes after that. She was carrying a grease-stained brown bag from which she pulled one coffee and two goldfish cartons. Steamed rice and crab bowl, she said. He passed on her offer and rolled his window down. He sipped the coffee she handed to him and grimaced.
Ah, tastes like it was made in Saigon and shipped over, he said. Did you get Rourke?
Yeah. He's going to get somebody to check Bok out and page me if they come up with anything. He wants to know on a radio patch through the minute the Mercedes starts moving.
2 hours passed easily as they small-talked and watched the gold Mercedes. Eventually, Bosch announced that he was going to break camp and drive around the block, just to change the pace. What he didn't say was that he was bored and his butt was falling asleep, and that he wanted to look for the white LTD.
"Do you think maybe we should call to see if he's still there and then hang up if he gets on?" she said.
If Bin gave him the warning, a call like that might shake him up, make him think something's going on, make him more cautious. He drove the car up to the corner and along the front of the shopping plaza. Nothing unusual caught his eye. He went around the block and parked in the same spot again. He had not seen the LTD. As soon as they were back in position, Wish's pager sounded, and she got out to go to the phone again. Bosch concentrated on the gold Mercedes and forgot about the LTD for the time being. But after Eleanor was gone 20 minutes, he began to get nervous. It was after 3 p.m., and Bok, a.k.a. Tron, had not left as they expected he would. Something didn't seem right. But what? Bosch looked up at the front corner of the shopping center, studying it and waiting for Eleanor to make the turn around the stucco siding. He heard a sound, like a muffled impact. 2 or 3 of them. Shots? He thought of Eleanor, and his heart was pushed by a fist up into his throat. Or had the sound been car doors closing? He looked at the Mercedes, but could only see the trunk and taillights. He saw no one around the car. Back at the front corner, no Eleanor. Then back at the Mercedes, and he saw the brake lights go on. Bok was leaving. Bosch started the car and drove up to the corner, his rear tires spitting gravel as he gunned it forward. At the corner, he saw Eleanor walking along the sidewalk toward him. He honked the horn and signaled for her to hurry. Eleanor trotted to the car and was just getting in when the Mercedes appeared in Bosch's rearview mirror and turned out of the alley toward them. "Get down," he said, and pulled Eleanor down on the seat. The Mercedes floated by and turned onto Bolsa. He released his grip on her neck.
"What the hell do you think you're doing?" she demanded as she came up.
Bosch pointed at the Mercedes, which was heading away. "They were coming by. You would have been made because you went in the office today. What took you so long?"
"They had to track down Rourke. He wasn't in his office."
Harry pulled out and started following the Mercedes from a distance of about 2 blocks. After a long moment composing herself, Eleanor said,
"Is he by himself?"
"I don't know. I didn't see him get in. I was looking up at the corner for you. I think I heard more than one car door close. I'm sure I did."
"But you don't know if Tron was one of them who got in?"
"Right. Don't know. But it's getting late. I figure it's got to be him." Bosch realized then that he might have fallen for the oldest ruse in the surveillance book. Bok, or Tron, or whoever he was, could have simply sent one of his minions in the $100,000 car to draw away the tail. "What do you think? Go back?" he said. Wish didn't answer until he looked over at her.
"No," she said. "Go with what we got. Don't second-guess yourself. You're right about the time. A lot of banks close at 5 before a holiday weekend. He had to get going. He was warned by Bin. I think it's him."
Bosch felt better. The Mercedes turned west and then north again on the Golden State Freeway toward Los Angeles. The traffic crept slowly into downtown, and then the gold car went west on the Santa Monica Freeway, exiting on Robertson at 5:20. They were heading into Beverly Hills. Wilshire Boulevard was lined with banks from downtown to the ocean. As the Mercedes turned west, Bosch felt they had to be close. Tron would keep his treasure at a bank near his home, he thought. The gamble had been right. He relaxed a bit and finally got around to asking Eleanor what Rourke had said when she called in.
"He confirmed through the Orange County clerk's office that Jimmy Bok is Nguyen Tron. They had a fictitious name filing. He changed his name 9 years ago. We should have checked Orange County. I forgot about Little Saigon. Also," she said, "if this guy Tron had diamonds, he might have used them all up already. Property recs show he owns 2 more shopping centers like that one back there, in Monterey Park and Diamond Bar."
Bosch told himself it was still possible. The diamonds could be the collateral for the real estate empire, just like with Bin. He kept his eyes on the Mercedes, only a block ahead now because rush hour was in full force and he didn't want to get cut off. He watched the black windows of the car move along the rich street, and he told himself it was heading to the diamonds.
"And I saved the best for last," Wish announced then. "Mr. Buck, also known as Mr. Tran, controls his many holdings through a corporation. The title of said corporation, according to the records checked by Special Agent Rourke, is none other than Diamond Holdings Incorporated."
They passed Rodeo Drive and were in the heart of the commercial district. The buildings lining Wilshire took on more stateliness, as if they knew they had more money and class in them. Traffic slowed to a crawl in some areas, and Bosch got as close as 2 car lengths behind the Mercedes, not wanting to lose the car on a missed light. They were almost to Santa Monica Boulevard, and Bosch was beginning to figure they were headed to Century City. Bosch looked at his watch. It was 4:50. "If this guy's going to make a bank in Century City, I don't think he's going to make it." Just then, the Mercedes made a right turn into a parking garage. Bosch slowed to the curb, and without saying a word, Wish jumped out and walked into the garage. Bosch took the next right and went around the block. Cars were pouring out of office parking lots and garages, cutting in front of him again and again. When he finally got around, Eleanor was standing at the curb at the same spot where she had jumped out. He pulled up, and she leaned into the window. "Park it," she said, and she pointed across the street and down half a block. There was a rounded structure that was built out to the street from the first floor of a high-rise office building. The walls of the semicircle were glass, and inside this huge glass room, Bosch saw the polished steel door of a vault. A sign outside the building said, "Beverly Hills Safe and Lock." He looked at Eleanor, and she was smiling. "Was Tron in the car?" he asked.
"Of course. You don't make mistakes like that."
He smiled back. Then he saw a space open up at a meter just ahead. He drove up and parked.
"Since we started thinking there would be a second vault hit, my whole orientation was banks," Eleanor Wish said. "You know, Harry, maybe a savings and loan, but I drive by this place a couple times a week, at least. I never considered it."
They had walked down Wilshire and were standing across the street from Beverly Hills Safe and Lock. She was actually standing behind him and peeking at the place over his shoulder. Tron, or Buck, as he was known, had seen her earlier, and they couldn't risk his spotting her here. The sidewalk was clogged with office types that were pouring through the revolving glass doors of the buildings, heading to parking garages and trying to get even a 5-minute jump on the traffic on a holiday weekend.
"It fits, huh?" Bosch said. "He comes here, doesn't trust banks like your friend at State was talking about, so he finds a vault without a bank. Here it is. But even better, as long as you have the money to pay, these places don't need to know who you are. No federal banking regulations because it isn't a bank. You can rent a box and only identify yourself with a letter or a number code."
Beverly Hills Safe and Lock had all the appearances of a bank, but was far from it. There were no savings or checking accounts, no loan department, no tellers. What it offered was what it showed in the front window, its polished steel vault. It was a business that protected valuables, not money. In a town like Beverly Hills, this was a precious commodity. The rich and famous kept their jewels here, their furs, their prenuptial agreements. And it all sat out there in the open, behind glass. The business was the bottom floor of the 14-story J.C. Stock building, a structure unnotable save for the glass vault room that protruded in a half-circle from the first-floor facade. The entrance to Beverly Hills Safe and Lock was on the side of the building at Rincon Street, where Mexicans in short yellow jackets stood ready to valet a client's car. After Bosch had dropped Eleanor off and gone around the block, she had watched Tron and 2 bodyguards get out of the gold Mercedes and walk to the Safe and Lock. If they thought they might be followed, they hadn't shown it. They never looked behind them. One of the bodyguards carried a steel briefcase. Eleanor said,
"I think I made at least one of the bodyguards as carrying. The other's coat was too baggy. Is that him? Yeah, there he is."
Tron was being escorted by a man in a dark blue banker's suit into the vault room. A bodyguard trailed behind with the steel briefcase. Bosch saw the heavy man's eyes sweep the sidewalk outside until Tron and banker's suit disappeared through the vault's open door. The man with the briefcase waited. Bosch and Wish also waited and watched. It was about 3 minutes before Tron came out,
followed by the suit, who carried a metal safe deposit box about the size of a woman's shoebox. The bodyguard took up the rear, and the three men walked out of the glass room, out of sight.
Nice. Personal service, Wish said. Beverly Hills all the way. He's probably taking it into a private sitting room to make the transfer.
Think you can get a hold of Rourke and get a crew over here to follow Tron when he leaves? Bosch asked. Use a landline. We have to stay off the air in case the people underground have someone up top listening to our frequencies.
I take it we're staying here with the vault? She asked,
and Bosch nodded. She thought a moment and said,
I'll make the call. He'll be glad to know we found the place. We'll be able to put the tunnel crew down.
She looked about, saw a payphone next to a bus stop on the next corner, and made a move to walk that way. Bosch held her arm.
I'm going to go inside, see what's up. Remember, they know you, so stay out of sight until they're gone.
What if they split before reinforcements come?
I'm staying with that vault. I don't care about Tron. You want the keys? You can take the car and tail him.
No, I'll stay with the vault. With you.
She turned and headed toward the phone. Bosch crossed Wilshire and went in the safe and lock, passing an armed security guard who had been walking toward the door with a key ring in his hand.
Closing up, sir, said the guard, who had the swagger and gruffness of an ex-cop. I'll only be a minute, Bosch said, without stopping.
Banker's suit, who had led Tron into the vault, was one of three young, fair-haired men sitting at antique desks on the plush gray carpet in the reception area. He glanced up from some papers on his desk, sized up Bosch's appearance, and said to the younger of the other two,
Mr. Grant, would you like to help this gentleman?
Though his unspoken answer was no, the one called Grant stood up, came around his desk, and with the best phony smile in his arsenal, approached Bosch.
Yes, sir, the man said. Thinking of opening a vault account with us?
Bosch was about to ask a question when the man stuck out his hand and said,
James Grant, ask me anything, though we are running a little short of time. We are closing for the weekend in a few minutes.
Grant drew up his coat sleeve to check his watch to confirm closing time.
Harvey Pounds, Bosch said, taking his hand. How did you know I don't already have a vault account?
Security, Mr. Pounds. We sell security. I know every vault client on site. So do Mr. Avery and Mr. Bernard.
He turned slightly and nodded at Banker's suit and the other salesman, who solemnly nodded back.
Not open weekends?
Bosch asked, trying to sound disappointed. Grant smiled.
No, sir. We find our clients are the type of people who have well-planned schedules, well-planned lives. They reserve the weekend for pleasures, not errands like these others you see. Scurrying to the banks, the ATMs. Our clients are a measure above that, Mr. Pounds, and so are we. You can appreciate that.
There was a sneer in his voice when he said this, but Grant was right. The place was as slick as a corporate law office, with the same hours and the same self-important frontman. Bosch took an expansive look around. In an alcove to the right, where there was a row of eight doors, he saw Tron's two bodyguards standing on each side of the third door. Bosch nodded at Grant and smiled.
Well, I see you have guards all over the place. That's the kind of security I'm looking for, Mr. Grant.
I beg your pardon, Mr. Pounds. Those men are merely waiting for a client who is in one of the private offices. But I assure you our security provision can't be compromised. Are you looking for a vault with us, sir?
The man had more creepy charm than an evangelist. Bosch disliked him and his attitude.
Security, Mr. Grant, I am looking for security. I want to lease a vault, but I need to be assured of the security from both outside and inside problems, if you know what I mean.
Of course, Mr. Pounds, but do you have any idea of the cost of our service, the security we provide?
Don't know and don't care, Mr. Grant. See, the money is not the object, the peace of mind is. Agreed? Last week, my next-door neighbor, I'm talking about just three doors down from the former president, had a burglary. The alarm was no obstacle to them. They took very valuable things. I don't want to wait for that to happen to me. No place is safe these days.
Truly a shame, Mr. Pounds, Grant said, an unbridled note of excitement in his voice. I didn't realize it was getting that way in Bel Air, but I couldn't agree more with your plan of action. Have a seat at my desk and we can talk. Would you like Coffee, perhaps some brandy? It is near the cocktail hour, of course, just one of the little services we provide that a banking institution cannot.
Grant laughed then, silently, with his head nodding up and down. Bosch declined the offer, and the salesman sat down, pulling his chair in behind him.
Now, let me tell you the basics of how we work. We are completely non-regulated by any government agency. I think your neighbor would be happy about that.
He winked at Bosch, who said, Neighbor?
The former president, of course.
Bosch nodded, and Grant proceeded.
We provide a long list of security services, both here and for your home, even an armed security escort if needed. We are the complete security consultant.
What about the safe deposit vault? Bosch cut in. He knew Tran would be coming out of the private office at any moment. He wanted to be in the vault by then.
Yes, of course, the vault. As you saw, it is on display to the world. The glass circle, we call it, is perhaps our most brilliant security ploy. Who would attempt to breach it? It is on display 24 hours a day, right on Wilshire Boulevard. Genius?
Grant's smile was wide with triumph. He nodded slightly in an effort to prompt agreement from his audience.
What about from underneath?
Bosch asked, and the man's mouth dropped back into a straight line.
Mr. Pounds, you can't expect me to outline our structural security measures, but rest assured the vault is impregnable. Between you, me, and the lamppost, you won't find a bank vault in this town with as much concrete and steel in the floor, in the walls, in the ceiling of that vault. And the electrical? You couldn't, if you excuse the expression, break wind in the circle room without setting off the sound, motion, and heat sensors.
May I see it?
The vault?
Of course.
Of course.
Grant adjusted his jacket and ushered Bosch toward the vault. A glass wall and a man-trap separated the semicircular vault room from the rest of Beverly Hills' safe and lock. Grant waved his hand at the glass and said,
Double-plated, tempered glass, vibration alarm tape between the sheets of glass to make tampering impossible. You'll find this on the exterior windows as well. Basically, the vault room is sealed in two plies of 3/4-inch glass.
Using his hand again like a model pointing out prizes on a game show, Grant indicated a box-like device beside the door to the man-trap. It was about the size of an office water fountain, and a circle of white plastic was inlaid on top. On the circle was the black outline of a hand, its fingers splayed.
To get in the vault room, your hand must be on file. The bone structure. Let me show you.
He placed his right hand on the black silhouette. The device began to hum, and the white plastic inlay was lit from inside the machine. A bar of light swept below the plastic and Grant's hand, as if it were a Xerox machine.
X-ray, Grant said. More positive than fingerprints, and the computer can process it in 6 seconds.
In 6 seconds, the machine emitted a short beep, and the electronic lock on the first door of the trap snapped open.
You see, your hand becomes your signature here, Mr. Pounds. No need for names. You give your box a code, and you put the bone structure of your hand on file with us. 6 seconds of your time is all we need.
Behind him, Bosch heard a voice he recognized as belonging to Banker's suit, the one called Avery.
Ah, Mr. Long, are we finished?
Bosch glanced around to see Tran emerging from the alcove. Now he was the one who carried the briefcase, and one of the bodyguards carried the safe deposit box. The other big man looked right at Bosch. Bosch turned back to Grant and said,
Can we go in?
He followed Grant into the man-trap. The door closed behind them. They were in a glass and white steel room about twice the size of a telephone booth. There was a second door at the end. Behind it stood another uniformed guard.
This is just a detail we borrowed from the L.A. County Jail, Grant said. This door in front of us cannot open unless the one behind us is closed and locked. Maury, our armed guard, makes a final visual check and opens the last door. You see, we have the human and electronic touch here, Mr. Pounds.
He nodded to Maury, who unlocked and opened the last door of the trap. Bosch and Grant walked out into the vault room. Bosch didn't bother to mention that he had just successfully circumvented the elaborate security obstacles by playing on Grant's greed and pitching a story with a Bel Air address.
And now, into the vault,
Grant said, holding his hand out like a congenial host. The vault was larger than Bosch had envisioned. It was not wide, but it extended far back into the J.C. Stock building. There were safe deposit boxes along both side walls and in a steel structure running down the center of the vault. The two began walking down the aisle to the left as Grant explained that the center boxes were for larger storage needs. Bosch could see that the doors were much larger than those on the side walls. Some were big enough to walk through. Grant saw Bosch staring at these and smiled.
"Furs,"
he said.
"Minks. We do very good business storing expensive furs, gowns, what have you. The ladies of Beverly Hills keep them here in the off-season. Tremendous insurance savings, not to mention the peace of mind."
Bosch tuned out the sales pitch and watched as Tron walked into the vault, trailed by Avery. Tron still had the briefcase, and Bosch noticed a thin band of polished steel on his wrist. He was handcuffed to the briefcase. Bosch's adrenaline kicked in at a higher notch. Avery stepped up to an open box door marked 237 and slid the deposit box in. He closed the door and used a key in one of the two locks on the door. Tron stepped up and put his own key in the other lock and turned it. He then nodded to Avery and both men walked out, Tron never having looked at Bosch. Once Tron was gone, Bosch announced that he had seen enough of the vault and headed out also. He walked to the double-plated glass and looked out on Wilshire Boulevard and watched Tron, flanked by the two massive guards, making his way to the parking garage where the Mercedes was parked. No one followed them. Bosch looked around but didn't see Eleanor.
Is something wrong, Mr. Pounds?
Grant said from behind him.
Yes, Bosch said.
He reached into his coat pocket and brought out his badge wallet. He held it up over his shoulder so Grant could see it from behind.
You better get me the manager of this place, and don't call me Mr. Pounds anymore.
Lewis stood at a payphone in front of a 24-hour diner called Darling's. He was around the corner and about a block from Beverly Hills Safe and Lock. It had been more than a minute since Officer Mary Grosso had answered the call and said she would get Deputy Chief Irving on the line. Lewis was thinking that if the man wanted hourly updates, by landline, no less, then the least he could do was take the damn call promptly. He switched the phone to his other ear and dug in his coat pocket for something to pick his teeth with. His wrist was sore where it chafed against the pocket. But thinking about being handcuffed by Bosch only made him angry, so he tried to concentrate on the investigation. He had no idea what was going on, what Bosch and the FBI woman were up to. But Irving was convinced there was a caper on, and so was Clark. If so, Lewis promised himself at the payphone he would be the one who would squeeze the cuffs on Bosch's wrists. An old tramp with scary eyes and white hair shuffled up to the payphone next to the one Lewis was at and checked the change slot. It was empty. He reached a finger toward the slot of the phone Lewis was using, but the IAD detective batted it away.
"Anything there, it's mine, Pop," Lewis said.
Undeterred, the tramp said,
"Yeah, quarters so I can get something to eat."
"Fuck off," Lewis said.
"What?"
a voice said.
"What?"
Lewis said, and then realized the voice had come from the phone. It was Irving.
"Oh, not you, sir. I didn't realize you were... I was talking. I'm having a problem here with someone I..."
"You speak like that with a citizen."
Lewis reached a hand into his pants pocket and pulled out a dollar bill. He handed it to the white-haired man and shooed him away.
"Detective Lewis, are you there?"
"Yes, Chief. Sorry. I've taken care of the situation now. I wanted to report. There's been an important development."
He hoped this last would draw Irving's attention away from the earlier indiscretion. Irving said,
"Tell me what you have. Do you still have Bosch in sight?"
Lewis exhaled, sharply, relieved.
"Yes," he said. "Detective Clark is continuing surveillance while I make this report."
"All right, then give it to me. It is Friday evening, Detective. I would like to get home at a reasonable hour."
Lewis spent the next 15 minutes updating Irving on Bosch's tale of the gold Mercedes from Orange County to the Beverly Hills Safe and Lock. He said the tale was terminated at the Safe and Lock, which appeared to have been the intended destination.
"What are they doing now, Bosch and the Bureau woman?"
"They're still in there. It looks like they are interviewing the manager. Something's going on. It was like they didn't know where they were going, but once they got to this place, they knew this was it."
"Was what?"
"That's it. I don't know. Whatever it is they're up to. I think the guy they followed made a deposit. There's a vault, a large vault in the front window of the place."
Yes, I know where you are talking about.
Irving did not speak for a long period, and Lewis, his report completed, knew better than to interrupt. He started daydreaming about cuffing Bosch's hands behind his back and walking him past a battery of television cameras. He heard Irving clear his throat.
I don't know their plan, but I want you to stay with them. If they don't go home tonight, neither do you. Understood?
Yes, sir.
If they allow the Mercedes-Benz to go on, then it must be the vault they wanted to find. They will place the vault under surveillance, and you, in turn, will continue to keep them under surveillance.
Yes, Chief, Lewis said, though he was still lost. Irving spent the next 10 minutes giving his detective instructions and his theory of what was happening with Beverly Hills safe and lock. Lewis pulled out a pad and pen and took some quick notes. At the end of the one-sided dialogue, Irving entrusted Lewis with his home telephone number and said,
Don't move in without my prior approval. You can call me at the number at any time, day or night. Understood?
Yes, sir,
Lewis said urgently. Irving hung up without saying another word. Bosch waited in the reception area without telling Grant or the other salesman what was going on until Wish arrived. They stood behind their fancy desks with their mouths open. When Eleanor came to the door, it was locked. She knocked and held up her badge. The guard let her in, and she walked into the reception area. As the salesman named Avery opened his mouth to say something, Bosch said, This is FBI agent Eleanor Wish. She is with me. We are going to step into one of your client offices for a private conversation. Just take a minute. If there is a head man here, we'd like to speak to him as soon as we come out. Grant, still flustered, just pointed to the second door in the alcove. Bosch went in the third door, and Wish followed. He closed the door on all three of the salesman's eyes and locked it.
So, what have we got? I don't know what to tell them, he whispered, as he looked around the desk and two chairs in the room for a scrap of paper or anything else Tron might have mistakenly left behind. There was nothing.
He opened the drawers of the mahogany desk. There were pens and pencils and envelopes and a stack of bond paper. Nothing else. There was a fax machine on a table against the wall opposite the door, but it was not turned on.
We watch and wait, she said, speaking very quickly. Rourke says he's putting together a tunnel crew. They'll go in and have a look around. They're going to get with DWP first to see exactly what's down there. They should be able to figure what the best spot for a tunnel would be, and then they'll go from there. Harry, you really think this is it?
He nodded. He wanted to smile, but didn't. Her excitement was contagious.
Did he get a tail on Tron in time? He asked. By the way, here they know him as Mr. Long.
There was a knocking on the door and someone's voice saying,
Excuse me. Excuse me.
Bosch and Wish ignored it.
Tron, Bach, now Long, Wish said. I don't know about the tail. Rourke said he was going to try. I gave him the plate and told him where the Mercedes was parked. Guess we'll find out later. He said he'd also send over a crew to work the surveillance with us. We're going to have a surveillance meeting in the garage across the street at 8 o'clock. What did they say here?
I haven't told them what's going on yet. There was another knock, this one louder.
Well then, let's go see the head man.
The owner and chief operating officer of Beverly Hills Safe and Lock turned out to be Avery's father, Martin B. Avery III. He was of the same stock as many of his customers and wanted everybody to know it. He had a private office at the rear of the alcove. Behind his desk was a collection of framed photographs attesting to the fact that he was not just another chiseler feeding off the rich. He was one of them. There was Avery III with a couple of presidents, a movie mogul or two, and English royalty. One photo was of Avery and the Prince of Wales in full polo regalia, though Avery appeared too thick around the middle and loose in the jowls to be much of a horseman. Bosch and Wish summarized the situation for him, and he was immediately skeptical. He said his vault was impregnable. They told him to save the sales pitch and asked to see design and operation plans for the vault. Avery III flipped his $60 blotter over, and there was the vault schematic taped to the back. It was clear that Avery III and his blow-cut salesmen were overselling the vault. Starting from its outermost skin and going inward, it was 1-inch steel plating, followed by a foot of rebarred concrete, followed by another inch of steel. The vault was thicker on the bottom and top, where there was another 2-foot layer of concrete. As with all vaults, the most impressive thing was the thick steel door.
but that was for show. Just like the hand X-ray and the man trap, only a show. Bosch knew that if the tunnel bandits were really down below, they would have little trouble coming up for air. Avery 3 said that there had been a vault alarm on each of the past two nights, including two alarms on Thursday night. Each time he was called at home by the Beverly Hills police, he in turn called his son, Avery 4, and dispatched him to meet the officers. The officers and the heir then entered the business and reset the alarm after finding nothing amiss. "We had no idea that there might be someone in the sewers below us," Avery 3 said. He said it like the word sewers was wholly beneath his usage. Hard to believe. Hard to believe. Bosch asked more detailed questions about the vault's operation and security devices. Not realizing its significance, Avery 3 mentioned matter-of-factly that unlike conventional bank vaults, his vault had a time lock override. He had a code he could enter into the computer lock, which would purge the time lock coordinates. He was able to open the vault door any time. "We must accede to our client's needs," he explained. "If a Beverly Hills lady should call on a Sunday because she needs her tiara for the charity ball, I want to be able to get that tiara for her. You see, it is the service we sell."
"Do all your clients know about that weekend service?" Wish asked.
"Of course not," Avery 3 said. "Only a select few. You see, we charge a hefty fee. We must bring in a security guard to do it." "How long does it take to do the override and swing the door open?" Bosch asked.
"Not long. I tap in the override code on the keypad next to the vault door, and it is done in a matter of seconds. You then set the vault unlock code in, then turn the wheel, and the door opens under its own weight. 30 seconds, perhaps a minute, perhaps less."
Not fast enough, Bosch thought. Tran's box was located near the front of the vault. That's where the bandits would be working. They would see and probably hear the vault door being opened. No element of surprise. An hour later, Bosch and Wish were back in his car. They had moved to the second level of the parking garage across Wilshire and east a half block from Beverly Hills Safe and Lock. From there they had an open view of the vault room. After they had left Avery 3 and taken the surveillance position, they had watched as Avery 4 and Grant swung the huge stainless steel vault door closed. They turned the wheel and typed on the computer keypad, locking it. Then the lights inside the business went out, all except those in the glass vault room. Those always stayed on to display the very symbol of the security they offered.
"You think they'll come through tonight?"
Wish asked. "Hard to say. Without Meadows, they're down a man. They might be behind schedule." They had told Avery 3 to go home and be ready for a call-out. The owner had agreed but remained skeptical of the whole scenario Bosch and Wish had spun for him. "We're going to have to get them from underground," Bosch said, his hands holding the steering wheel as if he were driving. "We'd never get that door open fast enough." Bosch idly looked to his left, up Wilshire. He saw a white LTD with police wheels parked at the curb a block away. It was parked next to a fire hydrant, and there were two figures in it. He still had company. Bosch and Wish stood next to his car, which was parked on the second level of the garage, facing the retainer wall at the south end. The garage had been virtually empty for more than an hour, but the drab concrete enclosure smelled of exhaust fumes and burning brakes. Bosch was sure the brakes smell was from his car. The stop-and-go tail from Little Saigon had taken its toll on the replacement car. From their position, they could look across Wilshire and west a half block to the vault showroom of Beverly Hills Safe and Lock. Farther down Wilshire, the sky was pink and the setting sun a deep orange. Evening lights were coming on in the city, and traffic was thinning out. Bosch looked east up Wilshire and could see the white LTD parked at the curb, its occupants' shadows behind the tinted windshield. At 8 o'clock, a procession of three cars, the last a Beverly Hills patrol car, came up the ramp and cut across the empty parking spaces to where Bosch and Wish stood at the wall.
"Well, if our perps have their lookout in any of these high-rises and they saw this little parade, you can bet he's pulling them out now," Bosch said.
Rourke and four other men got out of the two unmarked cars. Bosch could tell by the suits that three of them were agents. The fourth man's suit was a little too worn, its pockets baggy like Bosch's. He carried a cardboard tube. Harry figured him for the DWP soup Wish had said was coming. Three Beverly Hills uniforms, one with captain's bars on his collar, got out of the patrol car.
The captain was also carrying a rolled tube of paper. Everybody converged at Bosch's car and used its hood as the meeting table. Rourke made some quick introductions. The three from BHPD were there because the operation was in their jurisdiction. Interdepartmental courtesy, Rourke said. They were also on hand because Beverly Hills Safe and Lock had filed a design plan with the local police department's commercial security division. They would only observe the meeting, Rourke said, and be called on later if their department was needed for backup. Two of the FBI agents, Hanlon and Hauk, would work the overnight surveillance with Bosch and Wish. Rourke wanted a view of Beverly Hills Safe and Lock from at least two angles. The third agent was the FBI's SWAT coordinator, and the last man was Ed Gearson, a DWP underground facilities supervisor.
Okay, let's set the battle plans, Rourke announced at the end of the introductions.
He took the cardboard tube from Gearson without asking and slid out a rolled blueprint.
This is a DWP schematic print for this area. It has all the utility lines, the tunnels and culverts. It tells us exactly what is down there.
He unfurled a grayish map with smeared blue lines on it across the hood. The three Beverly Hills cops anchored the other end with their hands. It was getting dark in the garage, and the SWAT man, an agent named Heller, held a pen light with a surprisingly wide and bright beam over the drawing. Rourke took a pen out of his shirt pocket, pulled on it until it telescoped into a pointer.
Okay, we are right.
Before he could find the spot, Gearson reached his arm into the light and put a finger on the map. Rourke brought his pinpoint over to the spot.
Yes, right here,
he said, and gave Gearson a don't fuck with me look. The DWP man's shoulders seemed to stoop a little more in his threadbare jacket. Everyone around the car leaned in closer over the hood to study the location.
Beverly Hills Safe and Lock is here, Rourke said. The actual vault is here. Can we see your blueprint, Captain Orozco?
Orozco, who was built like an inverted pyramid, broad shoulders over thin hips, unrolled his drawing across the top of the DWP print. It was a copy of the drawing Avery III had shown Bosch and Wish earlier.
3,000 square feet of vault space,
said Orozco, indicating the vault area with his hand.
Small private boxes along the sides and freestanding closets down the middle. If they are under there, they could come up through the floor anywhere along these two aisles. So we are talking about a range of about 60 feet in which they could come through the floor.
Now, Captain, Rourke said, if you pick that up and we look back at the DWP chart, we can place that breakthrough zone right here. With a day-glow yellow underliner, he outlined the floor of the vault on the utility map.
Using that as a guide, we can see the subterranean structures that offer the closest proximity. What do you think, Mr. Gearson?
Gearson leaned over the car hood another few inches and studied the utility map. Bosch also leaned in. He saw thick lines he assumed indicated major east-west drainage lines, the kind the tunnelers would seek. He noticed that they corresponded to major surface streets, Wilshire, Olympic, Pico. Gearson pointed out the Wilshire line, saying it ran 30 feet below ground and was large enough to drive a truck through. With his finger, the DWP man traced the Wilshire line east 10 blocks to Robertson, a major north-south stormwater line. From that intersection, he said, it was just a mile south to an open drainage culvert that ran alongside the Santa Monica Freeway. The opening at the culvert was as big as a garage door and blocked only by a gate with a padlock on it.
I'd say that's where they could have come in, Gearson said. Like following surface streets. You take the Robertson line up to Wilshire, take a left, and you're practically here by your yellow line, the vault. But I don't think they'd dig a tunnel off the Wilshire line.
No? Rourke said.
How so?
Too busy is how so, Gearson said, sensing he was the man with the answers, as nine faces peered at him from around the car hood.
We got DWP people underground all the time in these main lines, checking for cracks, blockages, problems of any sort, and Wilshire's the main drag down there, east and west, just like up top. If somebody knocked a hole in the wall, it'd get noticed, see?
What if they were able to conceal the hole?
You're talking about like they did a year or so ago in that burglary downtown? Yeah, that might work again. Maybe somewhere else. But there's a good chance on the Wilshire line that it'd be seen. We look for that sort of thing now. And like I said, there's a lot of traffic on the Wilshire line.
There was silence as they took time to consider this. The engines of the cars ticked away the heat. Then where would they dig, Mr. Gearson, to get into this vault? Rourke finally said.
We got all manner of link-ups down there. Don't think us guys don't think of this from time to time when we're working down there. You know, the perfect crime and all that. I've had stuff like this around, especially when I read about that last one in the papers. I think if you are saying that that's the vault they want to get into, then they'd still do, just like I said, come up Robertson and then over on the Wilshire line. But then I think they'd move down one of the service tunnels to sort of stay out of sight. The service tunnels are 3 to 5 feet wide. They're round. Plenty of room to work and move equipment. They hook up the main artery lines to the street storm drains and the utility systems in the buildings along here. He put his hand back into the light and traced the smaller lines he was talking about on the DWP map.
If they did this right, he said, what they did was get in the gate down by the freeway and drive their equipment and all up to Wilshire and then over to your target area. They unload their stuff, hide it in one of these service tunnels, as we call them, and then take their vehicle back out. They hike back in on foot and set to work in the service tunnel. Hell, they could be working in there 5-6 weeks before we might have occasion to go up that particular line.
Bosch still thought it sounded too simple. What about these other storm lines? He asked, indicating Olympic and Pico on the map. There was a crosshatch pattern of the smaller service tunnels running from these lines north toward the vault. What about using one of these and coming up behind the vault?
Gearson scratched his bottom lip with a finger and said,
Well, that's fine. There's that, too. But the thing is, these lines aren't going to get you as close to the vault as these Wilshire offshoots. See what I mean? Why would they dig 100-yard tunnel when they could dig 100-footer here?
Gearson liked holding court, the idea of knowing more than the silk suits and uniforms around him. Having finished his speech, he rocked back on his heels, a satisfied look on his face. Bosch knew the man was probably correct on every detail. What about earth displacement? Bosch asked him. These guys are digging a tunnel through dirt and rock, concrete. Where do they get rid of it? How?
Bosch, Mr. Gearson is not a detective, Rourke said. I doubt that he knows every nuance of...
Easy, Gearson said. The floors of the main lines, like Wilshire and Robertson, are graded 3 degrees to center. There's always water running down the center, even most days during a drought. It might not be raining up top, but water flows, you know. You'd be surprised how much. Either it's runoff from the reservoirs or commercial use or both. Your fire department gets a call where you think the water goes when they're done putting the fire out. So what I'm saying is, if they had enough water, they could use it to move the displaced earth or whatever you want to call it.
It's got to be tons, Hanlon spoke for the first time.
But it's not several tons at once. You said they took days to dig this. You spread it out over days and the runoff could handle it. Now, if they're in one of the service tunnels, they'd have to figure a way to get water through there, down to your main line. I'd check your fire hydrants in the area. You got one leaking or had a report of somebody opening one up, that'd be your boys.
One of the uniforms leaned to Orozco's ear and said something. Orozco leaned over the hood and raised his finger above the map. Then he poked it down on a blue line.
We had a hydrant vandalized here 2 nights ago.
Somebody opened it up,
the uniform who had whispered to the captain said,
and used a bolt cutter to cut the chain that holds the cap. They took the cap with them, and it took the fire department an hour to get out here with a replacement.
That would be a lot of water, Gearson said. That would have taken care of some of your earth displacement.
He looked at Bosch and smiled, and Bosch smiled back. He liked when pieces of the puzzle began to fit.
Before that, let's see, Saturday night it was we had an arson, Orozco said. A little boutique in behind the stock building off Rincon.
Gearson looked at the spot Orozco pointed to on the blueprint as being the location of the boutique. He put his own finger on the fire hydrant location.
The water from both of those things would have gone into 3 street catches. Here, here, and here, he said, moving his hand deftly over the gray paper. These 2 drain to this line, the other drains here.
The investigators looked at the 2 drainage lines. One ran parallel to Wilshire, behind the J.C. stock building. The other ran perpendicular to Wilshire, a straight offshoot, and next to the building.
Either one, and we're still looking at, what, 100-foot tunnel?
Wish said.
At least, Gearson said, if they had a straight shot. They might have hit ground utilities or hard rock and had to divert some. Doubt any tunnel down there could be a straight shot.
The SWAT expert tugged Rourke's cuff, and the 2 walked away from the crowd for a whispered conversation. Bosch looked at Wish and softly said,
They're not going to go in.
What do you mean?
This isn't Vietnam. Nobody has to go down there. If Franklin and Delgado and anybody else are down there in one of these lines, there's no way to go in safely and unannounced. They hold all the advantages. They know we're coming. She studied his face but didn't say anything. It would be the wrong move, Bosch said. We know that